From the Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs at Brown University, this is Trending Globally. I'm Dan Richards. February 24th marks 2 years since Russia's invasion of Ukraine in 2022. Russia's assault in that first year shook the West, and Ukraine's defense of their territory captivated much of the world. The second year of this war, while no less consequential, has looked very, very different. International attention to the conflict has waned as battle lines have hardened, and as our guest on this episode explains, leaders on both sides of the war seem uninterested in looking for a negotiated end to the violence.
These people have staked their reputations on success in the war. And so they're very reluctant to kind of walk that back and say, well, you know, maybe I was wrong about these maximalist aims for this war. They're going to, unfortunately, resist such kind of compromises that the world needs and, above all, the Ukrainian people need.
So where does the war in Ukraine go next? Lyle Goldstein is the director of Asia Engagement at the think tank Defense Priorities and a senior fellow at the Watson Institute. In addition to being an expert on Russian military strategic development, he also has been following this conflict closely in the Russian media. On this episode, Lyle and I discuss how this war has evolved over the last 12 months. What does victory now mean in both the Kremlin and Kyiv? What might it take to bring both sides to the table to end this conflict? And what might an end actually look like? Lyle Goldstein, thank you so much for coming on to Trending Globally.
Oh, it's a great pleasure to be here again, Daniel.
How would you describe the state of this conflict, this war, now?
I see it really as it has developed in the character of a stalemate, which, of course, is surprising to a lot of us. Before the war, many thought Russia would easily, stomp all over Ukraine and take whatever it wanted. But, you know, of course, you know, somewhat shockingly, in a kind of David and Goliath moment, Ukraine succeeded in holding its own and defending its capital with great bravery and under extremely difficult conditions and with a lot of help. However, since that time, the battle lines have hardened, and although some of Ukraine's offensives in late 2022 did have some success, throwing the Russians back from Kherson and around Kharkiv. Nevertheless, 2023 has really seen a hardening of the lines.
According to a New York Times analysis, from January to September of 2023, only 500 square miles of territory changed hands amidst the fighting. As Lyle explained, though, this stalemate on the battlefield does not mean that Russia and Ukraine are in an equal position in this war right now. Ukraine, according to Lyle, is at nothing short of a crisis point.
Ukraine's army is not just running short of ammunition and suffering for lack of air cover, but, you know, after 2 years of war, it's a country that really has suffered devastating losses in terms of killed and wounded on the battlefield, and they're literally running out of able-bodied men. This is causing immense problems at all levels, I think, in Ukrainian society, including on the battle line chiefly, but among commanders, I think, who are somewhat demoralized as well.
Contributing to this demoralization is the uncertain support of Ukraine's most important ally, the United States. In January of this past year, just a month ago, funding for Ukraine from the U.S. essentially dried up. And as of this taping, there is no plan for further military aid to be provided to Ukraine in the year ahead. And if Ukrainians are feeling increasingly demoralized by the state of this war, many of Russia's leaders feel the opposite.
There's definitely a kind of change in tone, if you will. There's a spring in their step. From their point of view, kind of they weathered the worst. The Russian military over 2023 showed that it's very capable in defense, right? They shut down completely the Ukrainian counteroffensive. You know, they've gotten more organized. They have put their sort of military-industrial machine, and I should add their propaganda machine, into overdrive. More than that, they are feeling rather bullish after Russian forces seem to perform very well in the counteroffensive, inflicting, you know, massive losses on the Ukrainians.
So, as you describe, Russia's leadership is feeling a little more bullish at this moment in terms of their prospects in the war. And so maybe let's start there with Russia and Putin. Could you explain to listeners, as best as you know, how Putin frames his objectives in this war? What is victory for him at this point? Is it a Russian flag in Kyiv? Is it reclaiming the territory that they currently have under their control and ending the conflict there? What is success in his mind?
That is kind of the $64 million question. And my assessment is that Putin has been rather vague about this on purpose because, you know, from the moment this started, things started going wrong. So he's kind of adapted, you know, and while, you know, Russian sources will claim that it's crystal clear, my sense is that it's anything but crystal clear. I mean, look, at a minimum, I think his objective is to consolidate what they've gained. But I think in Putin's wildest dreams for how this war ends, he ends the war with not just the territory he's captured, but also the city of Kharkiv and also the city of Odessa. I don't think that they ever intended to conquer the whole of Ukraine because I think they understand that in Western Ukraine, you have people who have really never at all accommodated to Russian rule, and that would be just not at all realistic. Now, the question of Kyiv and Kharkiv and Odessa and the eastern domains of Ukraine, that's kind of a different question.
We spoke a little over a year ago about this war, and at that time, you described that you sensed Russian leadership was maybe approaching a point of being open to some sort of negotiation, like a beginning of some sort of de-escalation of some sort. How do you look at those prospects now, and how are you thinking about that?
Well, I mean, I recall making that suggestion because Russia had just suffered these reverses and had been thrown out of Kherson and back from Kharkiv substantially. Now, of course, the situation is different. Like I said, the wind is in the sails of the Russian war machine. It's definitely sobering to know that we now are 2 years into this. And, you know, let's face it, this could go on for 2, 3, or 5 more years.
Russia's bullishness and apparent commitment to this war was on display, especially in one of the stranger spectacles to come out of this war in recent weeks.
The following is an interview with the president of Russia, Vladimir Putin.
That is, of course, former Fox News host Tucker Carlson, who interviewed President Putin for his online news program in February.
The interview, as you will see if you watch it, is primarily about the war in progress, the war in Ukraine.
In the interview, Putin, through an interpreter, expressed interest in finding a path out of this violence.
Well, listen, I think I said that. We do not refuse to talk, to negotiate.
He went on to say that the United States should push Ukraine to negotiate. So far, neither Ukraine nor the United States have taken up Russia's offer. Lyle doesn't see Putin's desire to negotiate as completely disingenuous, although what exactly it would mean is unclear.
It's accurate to say that the Russians have always said they're ready to sit down today and talk about the end of this war. Now, talking is one thing, signing the paper or coming to the agreement or, you know, halting the their armies is another thing, of course.
So in terms of actions then, what do you think at this moment Putin would be willing to give up in a negotiation? If he feels like Russia is in a strong position, probably not as much as they would have maybe given up at another time. Is that fair to say?
As far as what the Russian side or Putin himself might settle for, you know, I'm pretty convinced that they have reconciled themselves to some kind of future in which Ukraine is heavily armed and supported by Western partners, if not part of NATO, but at least, you know, that they have some you know, this support is not going to end, but that Russia is kind of compensated with these territorial gains. I mean, I think that is what they're really aiming for. I don't think they have any illusions that they're going to convince, you know, most Ukrainians to either lay down their arms, demilitarize, quote, and have a positive feeling about Russia. I mean, they understand that many Ukrainians will hate Russia for generations. So the bitterness of war is going to be there.
And on the Ukrainian side, thus far, Ukraine's president, Vladimir Zelensky, has stated rather ambitious or maximalist goals for this war and definitions of victory. At the UN General Assembly in September, he called for Russia to withdraw from all land it has invaded since not just 2022, but 2014, which includes Crimea. How do you think Zelensky views victory in this war at this moment?
You know, I'm no expert on Zelensky. I can just, from observation, though, I hate to say it, he's a very skilled politician, and he has put himself into quite a box. And it doesn't help to, you know, he's constantly being, you know, let's say, patted on the head or on the shoulder by all these other world leaders and told what a great guy he is for this. But I mean, again, does that really help him come to the peace table? I don't think so. So he may be kind of deluded by this maximalist rhetoric and not, you know, fully understand just how dire the situation is.
Mm. Well, I want to turn to the U.S. for a little bit. We'll get back to Ukraine's politics and the view from Ukraine of this war a little later in the conversation. But Ukraine's aims in this war are ultimately tied up in their ability to maintain international support financially, militarily. And over the last 2 years, the United States has provided ample funding to Ukraine, although that funding largely dried up back in January. And it seems like there is not any guarantee that there will be more. At the same time, the U.S. is not pushing its ally, Ukraine, into negotiating with Russia. So I wonder, how do you see the U.S.'s role in helping to end this war, militarily or diplomatically?
You know, I would like to see the U.S. government in particular be much more active on this front. I'm very critical of the administration and that particularly the State Department has not engaged with Russia at all. You know, it's a sort of a policy of, you know, we wouldn't deign to speak with these barbarians, you know, that kind of attitude. They don't deserve to sit in the same room with us. You know, we certainly won't shake their hand, much less, you know, start to negotiate about an agreement.
Is that because of their behavior in Ukraine or just a general longer standing sort of ethos or an attitude towards Putin specifically?
All the above. Okay. And it's very it's sad. And I think, you know, not to give the Biden administration some props, they did agree to that face to face, I think, in 2021. With Putin, and there were some meetings. I think Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman met with Lavrov and tried, you know, so with some attempts were made, but to my estimate, they were not serious attempts. I really think, at a minimum, our diplomats should be working, burning that midnight candle, not just on different ways to kill Russians and sink Russian ships, which is what they seem to be mostly doing these days, that is, you know, the American government, but also to consider, you know, how we might bring this to an end. I mean, think about this, folks. If Wendy Sherman had succeeded in her mission to try to head off this conflict, then hundreds of thousands of people would be alive today. That should really make us think hard about the meaning of diplomacy.
And as for the idea that these two countries, Russia and Ukraine, will come to the negotiating table on their own?
I am somewhat skeptical of the idea that we're just going to kind of follow their lead. You know, any time people are involved in a war, these people have staked their reputations on success in the war. And so they're very reluctant to kind of walk that back and say, well, you know, maybe I was wrong about these maximalist aims for this war, that we need to make a compromise here. Well, that's, you know, almost impossible for a politician to utter those words, you know, compromise, or I may have made a mistake, or I may have overestimated our potential here. So to me, they're going to, unfortunately, going to resist such kind of compromises that the world needs. And above all, the Ukrainian people need such a compromise to get back to peace.
In other words,
this is going to require some tough talk. And, you know, the United States always, throughout its history, has been willing to talk tough with its allies and its partners.
One example of this type of tough talk that feels especially resonant at this moment.
During the Yom Kippur War, when Israel had been on the back foot and almost suffered a tragic defeat, but came back, surrounded the Egyptian Third Army. And, you know, the Israeli army was ready to not only seal the fate of the Third Army, but march to Cairo and, you know, do a parade down the streets in Cairo. And they could have done that. But the United States said, no, you cannot do that. That will shred the opportunity for peace, probably make the situation worse in the long run, and, you know, potentially start World War III. So they read the Israelis the Riot Act, and they said, no, you will release the Third Army from encirclement, and you will make peace and be satisfied with that. And guess what came out of that? The Camp David Accord of 1979, that may be one of the most important peace agreements of the 20th century. So, yeah, of course we should be willing to strong arm Kiev toward a peace agreement that's in their interest. And they may not be able to see that because they're too close to it, too emotional. And that's often a problem with combatants. But the United States should do the responsible thing and help move both sides toward an agreement.
So the U.S. is not the only superpower involved in some way in this war. I mean, not to mention the entire EU, but China is supporting Russia in some critical ways, militarily, financially. And you can't really understand the story of this war without also understanding some of the story of the relationship between the United States and China. And I wonder your thoughts about this past November, President Biden and Xi Jinping met at the APEC summit in California. And certainly the messaging at that time was that this was a productive meeting and sort of a hopeful beginning to a type of easing of tensions between these two countries. And I wonder just what did you sort of make of that bilateral summit? And do you have any idea of if and how Ukraine comes up in these conversations? Or is it really not a topic that these two have much interest in talking with each other about?
Boy, I would like to see that. It would be good, no question. You know, my appraisal of the recent meeting at the APEC was that it was quite a good meeting. I believe these U.S. and Chinese leaders should have these face-to-face meetings frequently, not just video conferencing for an hour here and there. I have long advocated that there be an annual summit meeting between Chinese and American leaders. I think the world would really welcome this kind of development. And that summit meeting should be, again, not hours, but days. That's how you get, you know, genuine breakthroughs. And should Ukraine be on the agenda? Absolutely.
Let's say the U.S. and China did decide to work together in some sort of concerted global effort to de-escalate this war, end this war. I know this is not like on the horizon in any meaningful way right now, at least publicly, but I'm curious, just even theoretically, what might that look like? How would these superpowers compel these countries to change?
I believe the way you bring, you know, these warring parties together is not, you know, necessarily by forcing them to make concessions, because that's just going to be incredibly hard, but rather inducing them with carrots. The decisions for peace in both Kiev and in Moscow are very hard. And so to put them over the top, to put both Kiev and Moscow over the top, they need to be convinced that they will be better off, and better off in the near, you know, in medium term, not in the long term, but in the near term. And that will require, you know, substantial economic boost for both countries, I think. And I mean, that's really going to be the only way. And between the U.S. and China, there's a lot of carrots that could be offered. And sanctions relief is pretty much the only way I could conceive of that, although I think the Chinese may have some other carrots too. But I mean, for the Americans to help bring the Russians back to the table, that will be chief among them.
As Lyle sees it, economic influence over Russia might, in the long term, be the most powerful weapon the U.S. has to offer Ukraine in ending this war.
sending more weapons and hoping to destroy more Russian ships or something like that, I honestly don't think that's going to be what brings Putin to the table. Putin, look, I think he would expend any amount of blood for his goals in Ukraine, unfortunately. But I think deep in his head, there is some kind of doubt about this. And the doubt really concerns the economic circumstance of Russia, which, you know, are really in some peril. Although I think in the short term, the Russian economy has done quite well to kind of weather the sanctions. But over the long term, I think Putin is deathly afraid that he will leave a Russia that's more impoverished, and that would be a huge embarrassment for him, you know, this man who claims, you know, to be the savior of Russia, or that's his own kind of self-conception.
And of course, this reminds me of what you said earlier about how sort of difficult it is politically for leaders to take anything less than full victory when they've put so much on the line. Which brings up another question I had. For this conflict to really end, might it mean a change in leadership in one or both of these countries?
Well, it could mean that. It was fairly common on Russian websites early on in the crisis. I mean, I'm talking, you know, a few months after the war started, for them to say, well, goodness, this is looking kind of like a disaster. You know, we've seen this movie before, and our, you know, our government has been overthrown. I haven't seen that lately. That was sort of more a late 2022 kind of discussion. But the fact that that was being discussed at all openly was pretty shocking and tells you something. Now, I mean, I think a lot of Westerners, journalists in particular, have put a lot of hopes in this, you know, kind of theory of if you will, theory of war termination, meaning like, okay, well, we just have to wait for reasonable Russian people to overthrow the Putin, and then we'll move on to a happy future somehow when they, you know, clearly admit this was a costly adventure. I don't think, you know, I think that's a lot of wishful thinking, almost just pie in the sky.
And what about Ukraine's leadership and Zelensky's future?
I can't say you know, he's a very brave man, very charismatic, but I don't know if I would give him high marks as a strategist or a realist. You know, in fact, there was some reporting, I think, in Time magazine and elsewhere that suggested a lot of his advisors and people around him have questions about the clarity of his thinking and wonder if he really truly understands the, you know, dire circumstances confronting the state. I believe they have basically canceled elections in Ukraine, which, you know, should be a bit troubling to all of us. But I mean, in some ways, it's understandable.
It's different than canceling an election in peacetime.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. There are a lot of just technical difficulties, never mind the fact that people are kind of extremely emotional and so forth. Anyway, so one can excuse that and understand that. But I mean, I think there has been whispering anyway among people who wonder how this goes, whether new leadership in Kiev could possibly take a different approach.
This topic received a lot of attention inside and outside Ukraine earlier in 2024 when Zelensky relieved his former top military general, Valery Zaluzhny, from duty. There was reportedly tension between these two men over both military tactics and over Zaluzhny's popularity and potential political ambitions. The dismissal was handled amicably in public. There's a picture of the two shaking hands and smiling the day after Zaluzhny was relieved. But it's likely not the last time we're going to see political and military tensions in Ukraine as this war continues its grinding path forward.
It's possible that somebody could take the country in a new direction that might involve peace negotiations. I mean, yeah, here it does seem that Zelensky might be too invested in the program of war, and again, by his kind of maximalist rhetoric, that he cannot kind of retreat from that. But somebody who's maybe better acquainted with the situation on the battlefield, like a, you know, general or something, might have a better idea. That could be possible. But my own view is that war and the situation on the battlefield lends a kind of reality to this that's inescapable. You know, we're hearing about, you know, tens of thousands of people being killed and grievously wounded every month. I don't think that's sustainable for either Kiev or Moscow. So I do think we're approaching a hurting stalemate, and I suppose this is at least as much hope as reality, but I do think they will, one way or another, come to their senses, because these level of losses and destruction is not sustainable over the long term.
Thinking about a way forward, Lyle brought up two different interesting historical examples we might be able to learn from. The first?
I mean, I'm quite focused on the possibility of a Korean-style armistice, where basically new borders are drawn up over the present stalemated battle line. It seems to me that that's the most logical and easiest way to get back to some kind of peace and almost a normal life for Ukrainians, first and foremost, but for the whole region. I study Korea as well. I was just there a few months ago, so I'm not saying that the Korean Peninsula is the ideal, but it, at least they're not slaughtering each other on a daily basis.
The second is an example from a little bit farther back in history of an outcome we do not want to see.
People don't really consider the Crimean War here, but I mean, this was 170 years ago, but basically Britain and France, this is in the 1850s before our own civil war, but they fought a horrible war against Russia for the same kind of open-ended objectives of trying to weaken and limit Russian power and punish them and for bullying their neighbors. And I think close to a million were killed and wounded. Finally, after years of war, Britain and France managed to weaken Russia and got the Russians to sign a piece of paper that they would dissolve the Black Sea Fleet. But within a few years, Russia was back at it, nibbling in the Balkans and with this Black Sea Fleet, and this attempt by Britain and France to tell Russia how to behave in its own backyard was a complete waste of effort. We might study that example, realize we're repeating history here, and try to move on from this and admit that mistakes have been made all around. But the humanitarians and pragmatists among us should lead us forward into a more peaceful future.
Which, to be clear, does not mean giving Russia everything it wants or selling away Ukraine's independence or promise for a better future.
I think Ukraine can be a viable and very successful state in the future. It might be smaller in form, but it is at huge loss in this war. It has gained, its kind of nationhood, its national ethos, through the heroism of the defenders of Kiev and Kharkiv and so forth. So, I mean, they have very much to be proud of. And that successful state can have, I could see it as a armed neutral, having one of the most powerful armies in Europe, and that would be viable and with a really a happy future. So let's get there, but we need peace in order to build that future, and just forever war is not the way.
Lyle, as always, this has been a sobering and enlightening conversation. And thank you so much for coming back onto Trending Globally.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. I'd love to come back and talk some more, Daniel.
This episode was produced by me, Dan Richards, and Zach Hirsch. It was engineered by Eric Emma. If you like Trending Globally, please leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And if you haven't subscribed to the show, please do that too. If you have any ideas for guests or topics for the show, send us an email at trendingglobally@brown.edu. Again, that's all one word, trendingglobally@brown.edu. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another episode of Trending Globally. Thanks for listening.